welcome again. So we'll be recording this and putting it on our website, which is at the end of the slides. It's radicalreference.info. And this workshop is The Importance of Community Needs Assessments in Activist Work. We were trying really hard to come up with a title that expressed it. It seemed that would draw people in without using a colon, which is really difficult. And I think most of the workshops usually start with some sort of catchy abstract phrase and then a colon that explains it in very plain language. So I guess this is the part after the colon. But we're volunteer librarians for Radical Reference, and for those of you who aren't familiar with Radical Reference, it was started during the RNC protests here in New York, and it was started as a way to provide street-based reference assistance for the people who are here protesting. So they had, were you here during that time? Mm-hmm. Do you want to explain it?
Yeah, there were a number of people in New York who came together to do street reference, and somebody made up fair trade baseball caps with the eye on them, and also the website took reference questions. So in the month before the RNC, we got questions like, you know, can you confirm this rumor that Police Commissioner Ray Kelly's son is going to be himself protesting them, and what are statistics about if that happened? And so since 2004, I think we've been growing and evolving, and the website is still up and takes reference questions, primarily from community activists and independent journalists. So you can take a look, and we do workshops at various venues like today.
Mm-hmm. And there are a number of local collectives. For those of you who live in New York, there's a really great active collective here who meets and tries to figure out what the community here needs in terms of librarian needs. There's collectives in Boston and one in LA and those areas. None in Philly or Baltimore.
I don't think Philly.
But that is, so that's Radical Reference. And I'm going to move to community assessment.
Okay. I'm Heather. We're going to basically just start off with kind of getting us situated in the context of just basically starting off with what is a community. How would you describe or define a community? Anybody have any thoughts on that?
A group of people with a commonality.
Okay.
Nice.
Very good. That's a good way to say it, because because communities can be based on where you live. It can be, people that live in Astoria, or it can be people that live in Germany, or people that live in your house. So, I mean, it can be scaled, obviously, any size like that, location-based, or it's also idea-based, people that have the same goals or interests or experiences. So, like, vegans or librarians or rape survivors, for example, just based on ideas, and, you know, as Pamela said in her talk, all over the world. So from there, we'll move into what is a community needs assessment. A community needs assessment is just basically a way to find out what the opinions are of your community, what they feel like they need, what they feel like they have, and what they feel like they could benefit from. It can also include things like demographic data or inferences from other communities. Sometimes they'll notice something about a community, and they'll look at data about the people, and it'll say, you know, that they're at this level of education, and so people will make these decisions for the community that they must need this because because this is what the data say, so this must be what the people need, without ever actually talking to the community itself. And that's not what we're talking about today. We're going to focus on the ones that actually involve the community and the importance of that and how that benefits you. In some cases, there will be data that will say that, you know, the unemployment rate is much higher for your community than for, you know, at the state level or whatever. And it could be that they need employment services. It could be that there's no jobs in the area or no transportation. But it could also be that they're all living on trust funds and they don't want jobs. So doing a community needs assessment will kind of help you tease out what's going on there and if there's multiple issues. It can also, it doesn't have to be, you know, data and analysis and all this kind of stuff. You could just, you know, talk to the people that are in your building, if that's your community. Or you could have a discussion. It could bring it up at the meeting of your organization, whatever it is. Or it could be larger and be a survey that you send out to hundreds of people and then collect that the information that way. Next, I want to talk just a little bit about why it's a good idea. I think it might seem a little bit common sense, but it's also it's one of those things that's common sense that people forget a lot. You know, it's a good way to find out what's on their mind, you know, versus what you think is on their mind, and what people in the community feel like, and if you're a member of that community, what you feel like too is obviously also valid. Also, if your group is looking to do for projects that'll be valuable to the community, for example, if your librarian's looking for a project to benefit people, you want to find out, you know, what resources you have that are going to benefit them. And so in order to do that, you need to know what they feel like they need. And you can also do it as in response to a previous program. Say you did something before. Lana will talk about this more. But if you did something before, if you want to see if it met the need, you could do a community needs assessment as evaluation, kind of to see how what you've done has helped or not helped, and what steps you need to take from there. So when are you going to do this? Whenever you're thinking about before, I guess, you're planning a program and you're trying to figure out what you can do to help. As I said, the same is for why you could do it. If you're thinking about writing a grant proposal, or if you've received a large donation of money and you need to figure out what to do with the money, it's very good for grant proposals because it gives you good information to give to the donating organization to say, you know, I've already done this groundwork and I have evidence that, you know, people are saying that they need this service and that they will use it. So it kind of shows that the money would be put to good use. Also, if you notice something that you think could or should be addressed, you might want to see if others feel the same way, rather before you start just, you know, acting on it. It might seem like something that's a huge deal, but like, let's say for example, you're noticing that in your neighborhood all of a sudden there's all these chain stores popping up. You might try to do something about it yourself, but if you did a community needs assessment first, you might find out that nobody else thought it was a problem. And so then you can realize, okay, before we try to change the situation, what I might want to do is increase the awareness of you know, why I feel like this is a problem, what are the impacts going to be, and why is this important to the community, before you would be able to get enough buy-in from the community to help you on your project. Does that make sense? Okay. So before you start, you need to think about what you have. How much time do you have? Are you trying to stop them bulldozing a building that's going to happen next month? Okay, you're definitely working on a much shorter time frame there. Is it a project that's just right now sort of an idea in the back of your head and it doesn't really matter when it happens, it's just something you think, you know, would be helpful? Obviously, then you have a little bit more time to work with. And so that's going to help you figure out which tools you can use to help you get the information that you need. And what level, what scale you can do of assessment. You also want to think about your money. Some methods are more expensive than others to do. Talking to somebody is relatively inexpensive, just one-on-one. But if you're trying to do surveys or if you need to facilitate a meeting and you pay somebody to do a meeting for you, that's going to cost money. do you have a lot of people to help? Is it a group? You know, are you doing this community needs assessment as a group of people? And so you have 20 people willing to talk to other people. That's good to know what kind of resources you have. Also, what sort of physical space do you have? Is there somebody that, you know, is there a place that you could have a meeting? Or is it everybody lives in a studio apartment, and so whenever you talk to somebody, you're going to need to be talking on either on their turf or you're going to have to rent a space or find a space, a library or whatever, to have your meeting. And also, think about whether you're a community that's looking for an idea or an idea looking for a community. You know, if you are in a group of... Hi! So you're... Oh, sure. There's a hand there. You're in a community of vegans, and you feel like, oh yeah, we definitely need to open a restaurant or whatever, and so then you kind of are, actually I guess then you're sort of both, and you know, but I guess you might want to go outside of your community and see if other people would use it, you know, because maybe there's only 10 of you, and you want to see if there's an interest in the community for using this new restaurant or whatever. You might be a community I guess that's more of having an idea and looking for the community to see if you have the community to support it. Or you could be, I'm going to use the radical reference example again, a group of librarians that has this great resource. You know how to find information. You know how to find resources. And you want to see what you can do to help a community. So then you're sort of an idea that's looking for a community. Knowing where you are on which side of that you're on is going to help you figure out, kind of help make your plan. Next, you're going to want to describe your community, and for this, you want to make it specific to the audience for the message that you're trying to get out. Not too broad. You don't want to talk to, for example, if you're thinking about the need for child care services, you're not going to target everybody in the community because not everybody has kids, and you're not even going to target like married people, because not just, you know, not all married people have kids, and not all people that have kids are married. You're going to definitely want to target parents there. Another thing that seems like common sense, but sometimes trying to focus, you know, whether you want to talk to, if you're interested in, for example, adding a bicycle path, do you want to talk to everybody in Williamsburg or just bicyclists between 19 and 50 or 19 and 30, or, you know, that's going to help you kind of preserve or conserve your resources, so you're not spending money on people that are obviously outside the scope of your project or outside of the community. And when you're doing this, you're not really when you're trying to describe your community, you're not making any judgments about them, or you're not assessing the community or telling them what they need to begin with. What you're kind of doing is considering factors that might translate to behavior. So if you're talking about bicyclists, it's going to help you figure out ways that you can get into their already pre-existing communication channels. You know, you would talk to, you know, you would go to bicycle shops. You would talk to, you know, that kind of thing. Rather than, so you're not saying, oh, I think that you think that we need a bicycle path. You're just trying to focus your efforts, basically. And that's the important part of describing your community. And while you're doing this, you might want to think about people that are key players in the community, whether there's leaders or longstanding members that have huge social networks of their own. This would be a good time to identify those people. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. These people are going to help you be able to get a sense of the big picture and help you, again, tap into existing channels of communication within the community. They'll be able to tell you who else you need to talk to really understand what the community feels like. And then the next thing you want to do is, yeah. Okay, that was a lot. I'll just stop and breathe for a minute. Does anybody have any questions, any sort of place I lost you or anything that you need clarification on?
One thing I just think that was really interesting you brought up was the concept of parallel and intersecting communities. The example of the vegan restaurant. And I think that you know, you don't need, if you're, you know, trying to develop something for a specific community that's inside or around other communities, you don't need to design it, you know, you can still design it with that community in mind, but then you need to take a step back and figure out how it's going to affect and how it's going to be received and how it's going to interact with the other communities. And that also ties into when you're talking about, you know, taking a step back and doing education or agitation prior to garnering support for something.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can develop a seed within one community and then take a step back before trying to sell it to a larger one.
Right.
And I think that's a really good visual kind of intersection of parallel communities that kind of made things a lot clearer.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a really good way to put that. I feel like you said it better than I did.
I have a question. Just thinking about, you know, surveying a community, are there any studies, or do you know what the current thinking is on how, you know, being asked something influences people's behavior. Like, do you know what I mean? If you're saying, like, would you like a vegan restaurant, just the fact that somebody's asking you might make you more willing to say, like, hey, sure, but then once it's open, you know, it's really not that important to you and you never go. So is there,
That's definitely something to consider, that you're right. Sometimes people do respond just because they're asked, and there are definitely some studies about that. I guess that's why you might find it more... I guess we'll kind of get to that in a little bit when we talk about, like, the specific tools for the... because I think you might find it more helpful in that case to... That's maybe one of the benefits of talking to people in person versus like a paper survey, because that way you can find out, you know, you can make sure that you're asking questions that are going to get around the idea of just like, you know, do you think this is a novel idea versus, you know, how would you use it or when would you use it or that kind of thing. Does that help? Okay. Yeah.
I think also, especially if you're not in your own community, instead of presenting... asking the question of what the need is before you present the resources you have available, because even if that limits what you can do, you're then putting ideas out there. Kind of, it's, even if it's on, if it's not verbal, you're asking, oh, well, would you like X or XYZ? And it's, you know, oh, yeah, sure, XYZ is great, but really, you know, A is what we really need. And so not mentioning, even if it's just, you know, limits that you actually have that aren't flexible limits, not mentioning those until you... ask a much open, much broader question first.
You're right, good point.
Very important thing.
Right, you're right. We don't want to kind of tip your hand so, so that you're not putting ideas into people's heads. Okay, is there anything else? Thanks. Welcome to everybody who came. We're at the point now where it's sort of right before you start your community needs assessment. You want to make sure that you kind of describe your community and figure out who you're trying to reach out to, how these communities intersect with other communities that might have either the same or complementary needs. And then the next thing that you're going to want to do is you need to know, and this is something that I think is a really tough part, is you want to figure out what you want to know and how you're going to find out. And this is where we get into the idea of, you know, making sure that you're not too specific and also not too broad. You don't want to just say, you know, how is everything or what would you like to see change? If you're in this case, let's say that you're a community and you want to do something that you have a lot of resources such that you can help out in environmental ways, for example. You might want to make sure that you target questions along those lines, but without giving specific ideas. For example, you might, you know, say, you might ask questions about, you know, have they noticed places that they felt like were polluted to the point where they worried about their health, or, you know, how they feel about their water resources, or whether they feel... what, even things like, you know, whether they've noticed that they felt ill or this kind of thing. You want to, and in questions that would be more quality of life, I guess, with environment too, like where do you go to, where do you go when you feel like you need to get out of the city, you know, that kind of thing. So you don't want to just ask, you know, what would you change or what do you think is a good idea, what do you need, that kind of thing. Unless it is... I don't know. I think in most cases you kind of have some idea of where you can help. This has to do with knowing the determining what you have stuff that I was talking about earlier, where you figure out what you have, what resources you have, what skills you have, and time and money, and try to figure out these are the kinds of things that these are the resources that we have, and so these will probably be the ways we need to help. And so how can we find an intersection of our resources and the community's needs? So one thing that you definitely want to do is figure out what you're going to talk about ahead of time. If you're doing an interview, you want to definitely know what you're going to ask and how you're going to say it. You definitely don't want to wing it in this case, because it can end up either looking like you can say something wrong and it looks disrespectful, and then now you've alienated this member of the community, or you could look unprepared and then it looks like you're not being respectful of their time. And so because you're trying to as part of this, I don't even think I've said this yet, but as part of this community needs assessment, another benefit of it is that it's creating bonds between you and other members of the community or you and the community that you're working with. These are the people that are going to help you either advance the idea, or they're the people that are going to kind of block the idea if they decide that they don't like what you're doing, or if they decide that they don't like you, that they feel like you're trying to act on the community, or that you're not being respectful or whatever, then they're going to get in the way, even if it's something that they might actually feel they might actually need or want. They'll block the effort if you're not careful about, you know, how you talk to people, if you're not talking to them respectfully. So there are a lot of different ways to make decisions about what a community needs. Like I said, there's some that are just data-based, or some that are inferences from other communities where, you know, this worked really great over here, so we think it's going to work really great over there. But we're going to just talk about the ones that have to do with getting feedback from the community, specifically having direct communication with community members. We want to make sure that you aren't doing something to a community. You know, you don't want to kind of impose your help or your assistance on the community. You want to do it with the community. It's going to affect the level of buy-in that you have the amount of the people actually use the services that you're providing, and it's going to affect definitely the support that you get from the community members. Are there any questions or thoughts?
When in the process to involve other people from the community?
Yes. Okay. Right, this is all just planning so far. And now I'm going to get to the parts where this is where you're actually involving the community. Up until then, you know, like I said,
we didn't have a chance to go over this before this, so, I think also when you're determining, before, Heather's going to get into involving other community members along the process, but also in here, you know, when you're deciding what the issues and the questions are, you're doing that with other community members, too, or when you're deciding, like, where to narrow the focus.
Right, exactly. While you're narrowing your focus and figuring that out, obviously you're going to involve other people, especially if you're a member of this community already. You know, you're going to be working with other community members to find that out. So the three methods I'm going to go over, the first of those is interviewing people. And you can either, it's usually, which is obviously communication via an interview with one or two people. In any case, it's a really small group. Because there's only, you know, it's a small group, communication can be really, it's a lot easier. It's a lot more iterative, basically. You know, you're talking and they're talking, and you can make sure that you're really understanding, and so hopefully there's less misunderstanding in that way. And also, though, it's also really important there that you're thinking about what you're saying and that you're being sensitive to whoever you're talking to and not wasting their time or whatever. You can, as I was saying, you can ask for clarification if you feel like you're not understanding somebody or whatever. As I was mentioning before, when you think about who your community leaders are, this is where you would contact those people to find out, you know, who else you should talk to. You know, you would obviously find their opinions important, but then you would also want to ask them who else you should talk to, especially if the group is so large that you're not able to talk to everybody, or if there's time is limited and you aren't able to talk to everybody, then this is going to help you pick out some people that, you know, maybe have some very strong opinions or already have something going on or whatever. You can also bring a small group of people together in a focus group, and the idea with a focus group is that it's a small group of people that and then they can kind of play off of each other and kind of create synergies, and sort of this is a really good time for the community members to kind of take on the idea of what you're thinking, try to help. This is the part that I was talking about, the direct communication, where you're kind of getting ideas from them about what they need, and this might be helping you figure out what you're going to take to the larger group, if it is a larger group. Does that make sense? Okay. The advantages of interviews is that it's personal communication and that, you know, close contact, so you can talk and ask for clarification and whatever. There's not as much planning involved as far as finding a space to meet or crowd control if it's going to be a large group or finding a good time and date where everybody's going to be able to come, because it's just an appointment between you and one other person or you and a few other people. So it's a lot easier to pick a good time. Some of the disadvantages are that it's time consuming to talk to everybody in the community, and so then you end up taking a sample, and so then you might end up missing some really important ideas from other people. And if you do have limited time, then you might not be able to handle it. And if you don't have 20 people that are willing to interview other people, then that could be a lot of work for one person. Has anybody had any experience with this, interviewing members of the community for community needs assessment, or basically just asking people what they're looking for?
I spent all of last January in El Salvador doing community needs assessments with 7 communities, and we had resources to go to 3 and work on projects. And I was working with a woman from Japan who was employing an Argentine model of community needs assessments, which was over the course of 4 months, 8 trainings, and it's with a representative, but it's about 10% of the community takes part in it, and this is obviously a much longer term and in depth and more involved in creating a process that will be sustainable after the outside agents leave. But it's based on basically a series of just immediate needs assessments and kind of material needs or social problems and identifying them, and then a month-long essentially discussion of what the roots and causes of those things are and how those are connected. And so it's a lot of diagrams and kind of historical research into those things in the community.
And the community members are helping
the
with
community members are doing
research?
It.
Okay.
It's facilitated, right? It's facilitated by someone who's trained from outside, but they're just facilitating it. So they have models of ways to research histories of problems, ways to research interactions and roots of problems. But all of the answers and all of the blanks need to be filled in by the community and community members. And so then at the end of it, the end result is a list of basically exportable ideas. The model this ties into is really based around, which is problematic and is very centralized, but is projects that they can do on their own, and then projects require outside funding. So things that are very single entity things that you can write a grant for, write an application for, and get an NGO or the government or whoever to fund it. So the project was a list of things prioritized by the community of what they projects, concrete things that they would want to work on and wanted to do, and had concrete ways to enact those things.
Great.
And that was a really great model, and it was really cool to spend some time working with that.
Cool.
Can I ask, when you say if the community was doing it themselves, are you talking about volunteers within the community, or are you talking about, for instance, government or libraries or schools? Who is... Yeah, and if it is volunteers, how did you find them, or how did they get involved?
This is basically only... the place I was doing it was all in communities of under 150 families, mostly around 60 families per community, so really small, very geographically isolated communities, with usually under 200 people that are part of it. So often it was, one person per every family or something like that. And it was all volunteers.
So did they decide they needed that, or did someone kind of get, their attention?
The way that this is all super specific, and I kind of came in, I wasn't the one facilitating these trainings. I came in kind of as basically with money to do projects to link up to it afterwards, but I was exposed to a lot of the process and how they were doing it. And the way this kind of air situation works out is it's an ex-guerrilla community area, and so all the communities in this area are ex-guerrilla communities. And so they have the organizational structures left over from the war, kind of tied on, is now their political organization. And so there's community leaders that are organized and that are coordinated by a geographic, a central coordinating group. And so they basically reach out to communities that were interested in the program, and those communities organize volunteers in the community. So it wasn't outside in the sense that it was an organic organizational structure from in the past 30 years that set it up and reached out for outside help to do the trainings. So.
Cool. That's actually really good. That's kind of something reminds me of something I forgot to say or said not entirely or whatever. But the idea that while you're doing your planning, it's definitely that's a really good time that you can avoid the idea of doing something to a community by creating committees within the community of people that will then help you with your effort.
Working with existing ones.
What's that?
Or working with existing ones.
Right, exactly. Or working with existing communities or existing committees of people that are already working on things. So basically then you're kind of like unifying the efforts or whatever, coordinating them so that you've got people, members of the community that are actually that are actually getting the information from the community. Does that make sense? Rather than, me asking all the questions of a community that I'm not a part of, you have other members of the community going out to their communities and getting the information. And that can happen, as I was saying, with the interviews or the focus groups. Another way to do it is a public meeting, which is a much larger scale. And it can be open to everybody and you can definitely advertise it, do targeted, like kind of where you're publicizing it so that you're making sure that the right people, or not the right, but the people that would be most interested in it would know about it. And anybody that wanted to either express concerns or hear what people's concerns are would be able to come to the meeting and talk. The main thing that you need to know with this is that anytime you're going to have a large group of people together, you're going to need somebody that knows how to facilitate a meeting. It's not something, again, this isn't something that you would just want to, like, wing, There's a book on the bibliography, which is the second to last slide there, on the art of facilitation. And it talks about a lot about, basically when you're facilitating a meeting, when you're not trying to give people information, you're trying to facilitate communication to try to help, to kind of encourage people to speak. That's one of the things that you kind of need to know how to do. And there's people that do it professionally. If you have money, you might be able to have somebody like that hold the meeting. Otherwise, you definitely need to do some reading and research and everything before you try to do that, or else it could, if there's contentious issues or if there's heightened tensions already and you bring everybody together to kind of air their grievances, it could make the situation worse instead of being like a forum for communication between people that is going to stay, that's going to actually be helpful and beneficial. The other problem with the advantages of having a public meeting is that a lot of opinions are gathered in a much shorter time. You don't have to talk to everybody individually. Everybody can come up and tell you, and it's one time and place. But because of that, that's like I said before, the having trouble figuring out when to hold it. If it's Thursday night, maybe these people are meeting, and if it's during the day, then these people might be at work, and if it's at night, then these other people are at work. So it's a lot harder to try and figure out a good time when everybody's going to be able to make it. You're never going to get everybody, but just enough people so that you have a representative number. Another disadvantage is that it's self-selection. You have to get people to come to the meeting. Only the people that are there are going to be able to express their opinions and what they feel like is needed. Another situation that can happen is that somebody could sort of hijack the conversation, somebody that would be more vocal might be talking over somebody or intimidate somebody that is less comfortable with talking in a crowd. People might be less likely to be completely upfront in front of a crowd as they would if it was just a one-on-one kind of thing. So there's some sort of pros and cons, and this is like why you have to try and figure out which one's going to work best for you and your situation. And finally, I'm going to talk about surveys. This is a lot of times what people think about first when they think about trying to gather opinions is, oh, we'll send out a survey. I feel like it's really hard to get a survey that is that's actually helpful and actually gives you beneficial information. The idea being, you know, you can ask questions that, you know, you can answer on a scale of 1 to 10, so you end up with these numbers, and, you know, people like qualitative data, and you can also ask open-ended questions, so people can give you their answers, you know, and write it out and have time to think about it. And so that's kind of a benefit, but it's really hard to ask a question that doesn't end up coming out ambiguously on paper. I was working on a committee not long ago, and the committee was to design a questionnaire. And we were all librarians, and we were supposed to be designing this questionnaire for librarians. And we all came with one question that we thought should be on the questionnaire. And going over those, there were ambiguities there. You know, the five of us sitting in the room interpreted the questions differently. Oh, I thought you meant, was this more helpful than that? Or I thought, you know. So it's actually a lot harder than you think. And then another thing that happens is you get all this information and then you don't know what to do with it. You know, it's like, great, so it looks like water is a 6. You know, I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean anything, you know. So surveys are definitely a lot harder than they seem. It seems nice and easy to, you know, you can pull together a Zoomerang survey in 5 minutes and, you know, ask your 3 questions and send it to your 1,500 people on Facebook and think that you're going to get all this useful information. But if you're not really careful with how you word it and what you're asking, you might end up with a whole lot of nothing, basically. And now you've already asked these people these questions, and if you ask them again, they'll feel like, well, why would I do it again? You didn't do anything with it the first time. So that's actually a lot of downsides. The good sides are it's easy, and well, no, it's not easy. I guess it's easier to contact a lot of people. You can either mail them, or you can email everybody. So you can have initial contact with a lot of people. Another disadvantage to that is, again, it's self-selection. You're only hearing from the people that answered. And that could be most of the people that have strong opinions, but maybe not. You know, maybe somebody is still trying to put together their answer, worded exactly right, and the deadline passes, or, you know, their cat gets sick, and they never do it. You know, so it's one way to do things. I don't know that it's necessarily my favorite from personal experience. Another benefit of it is that you can test the questions out on people. You know, you might not be able to pull together a test audience for a public meeting, but you can definitely, like, hand out the thing to your friends and see how they're interpreting the questions that you're asking and kind of tighten up the questions that way. So are there any questions about surveys, interviews?
I just wanted to say that I guess another good thing about surveys is I don't know if it's one. I find it to be not one of the most helpful things for you as an organization yourself. But when you are writing grant proposals or you're looking for outside assistance, some people only use sort of quantitative based results as their basis for granting you
right.
funds or resources. And sometimes it's just helpful to have that in addition
Definitely.
To some of the qualitative stuff, so that you know people can use that and say, okay, well, I'll give you this much money for this reason. And for your own purposes, you have, you know, all
numbers.
Of the other...
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
You're right. And I'm glad you said that. I forgot. but that is one of the good points, is that you do get both quantitative and qualitative data from a survey.
Right.
Yeah. So, if the funding institution is only interested in the numbers, then you're going to need to have something like that.
Right.
You're right. That's true. I mean, I guess another way that you can do this is have the public meeting and then give the survey afterwards and hope people then, you know, have had time to collect their thoughts and think about things, and maybe then that would be a good time to do it.
I think that's helpful, like combining methods can sometimes kind of like wash out the bad parts of them. Like if you just give out a survey, it's like your words that you're using, but if you have a meeting, you pay attention to what people are saying, you can like repeat their words back to them, so like, the things that you're asking on the survey make sense, and you actually get the, you know, the numbers mean something to them.
That's a good idea. Yeah, that's definitely true. Any other thoughts on surveys or any of the methods or any other or questions about them? Because I know I went through this really, really fast. It's only an hour. This is the kind of thing that as Sean brought up, you could talk about for 8 weeks. Or so this is just kind of a quick and dirty introduction. But whatever method you choose, you're going to end up with a whole bunch of answers, hopefully, a whole bunch of responses, and you're going to need to do something with those. And so, Monica, talk to us about that.
Hi. For those of you who can relate, we're volunteer librarians for Radical Reference. And we are recording this, so A, we're recording this, and then B, it'll be on our website if you want to hear the beginning part of this. And so for evaluating the results, I'm going to be more focusing on qualitative information because that's what I'm assuming most of you will be coming out with. And so when you're doing all of these focus groups, interviews, stuff like that, you know, you could either choose to record it and work from the audio or transcribe it or be taking notes or something like that. But you're going to have a huge chunk of written information that you've gathered from all these different people. So one method that works for sort of quantifying qualitative information that we're recommending is that to develop codes or more like themes for what subjects have emerged from the qualitative information that you've gathered. And it could be related to, you know, you could start off by working with the themes that came up in the questions that you used, or it could be just when you're listening to it, you know, something as concrete as someone saying that the community needs a literacy program, or something as abstract as there's not enough of a sense of community or sense of place within the group. So these codes are malleable to whatever research you're working on and what would work best for you. But you want to come up with the themes that are emerging from it, and then really, like, logistically speaking, I think that it's easiest if you go through and give each theme a number, and if while you're reading through it, you're finding more of these. But then when you're going through the actual documentation of the interviews and the focus groups you've had, and you see instances of those themes coming out, just put the right number next to it, and then when you're done, you can pull out all those little snippets that have come from these different people and these different interviews and focus groups and have them all listed together underneath their theme. So that way, at least, you're not working with 100 pages of transcription from interviews that you've had, but you're working with the key points where, you know, something, if an issue keeps coming up again and again, you can see how many times it actually came up and what people's thoughts are on it. So then once you have all those themes pulled out from your information, you know, what really did come up? How frequently is it referenced? And this is sort of a way that you can get around if there's people who you're working with. Like, I'm going to go with the instance that you probably have. It's probably more than just you who's been doing the community's assessment to begin with. But if there's someone who's in that group who sort of had biases to begin with on what they thought the community needed, this is a way to sort of pull out what was really needed so that it's not weighted towards someone who still really thinks that you need to have a computer lab set up in this group. But really, maybe the community says that they can use the library, so they really need, like, more computer literacy classes or something like that. And then once you get going with this, and obviously I'll point out, I mean, from what Heather said, this is a very time-consuming process, but I feel like from my experience using them, it really pays off in the long run because the efforts that you're putting into it and also in all my cases, we've had to find funding, so being able to document that your idea is coming from somewhere is a lot easier to sort of get grants and be able to justify why you need the money for it. So once you're from there, you and your group members will want to document what you've come up with. This sort of can be of whatever length makes sense for your group, but you want to be able to have something that you can reference as you're building a timeline and referencing back for the plan that you're coming up with. Most community needs assessments, when you document them, they'll have, you know, community decisions, what methodologies you use, if you used focus groups, interviews, when they were conducted, by whom, what questions, stuff like that, as well as quotes and what your findings are from them and what conclusions you've drawn from that. And when you're writing this, you want to be sure to keep in mind what resources you'll have available to implement them. So if people need a computer lab in this community, but you know that's something that's not going to be feasible, then you can make recommendations for what a secondary need might be, or if that comes up as a large enough need, on how to reach that point. So now that you have your information documented, you'll want to figure out how to implement it. And from that, of course, you really want to outline step by step what sort of resources will be needed to do this and what your timeline is. Like how Heather was saying, if you're trying to stop a building from being demolished in a month, you probably didn't have very much time to do the community assessment to begin with. It's probably a matter of days or a week at the most. But, you know, is this something that needs to happen in a year? Did you learn from talking to people that, you know, are you going to lose buy-in from community members if you're promising something or you want to create something but it's going to take 5 years to do? Like, is that something, will that need still exist in 5 years when that resource is finally provided? So what are your time constraints? What resources do you need? How many people do you need to help out with this? You know, what sort of skill sets do you need from these people, and where are you going to go to get these skills? What sort of materials do you already have within your community? Are there already groups or committees of people who you can tap into for that stuff? How much money are you going to need, you know, and are you going to need space? Are you going to need to ally with other groups? And what, in the end, will really be feasible for this? And also, I mean, I think that all along this should be going on, but especially now, is what sort of partnerships can you make with the other groups that, you know, either intersecting communities or maybe not intersecting, but what groups are providing these services already? Are you duplicating any efforts that are already going on? Like, I mean, I keep getting sidetracked. The communities assessments that I've done have been for libraries. So, for example, let's say you're working in a community that says that they want to have literacy programs, but you recognize that the library has literacy programs. But by talking to them, you also recognize that the library's short-staffed and has a waiting list that'll take 2 years to get people onto it. So you're recognizing then that, you know, you could partner with the library to see what sort of resources they're using, how they're training their literacy volunteers, but then be able to meet the need of these people don't want to wait 2 years, so we can provide a complimentary service to this. I feel like so often in leftist radical groups, we forget how many shared experiences and shared situations there are among these different groups. So thinking of how you can partner with these other people to do that. Does anyone have anything to say on that or what I've covered so far? I'm going to talk a little bit about funding because, you know, probably these communities aren't going to have a lot of resources to help implement this stuff. So from a grant standpoint, for those of you who are in New York, and there's also locations in D.C., San Francisco, Atlanta, and Cleveland, is the Foundation Center, which is on your bibliography at the end. But that's a really good starting place for grants, either as individuals, if you're working on a project, or for groups, nonprofits. The website's foundationcenter.org.
Also, the Central Library in Brooklyn, we have a computer. I think it's still there where you can search the Foundation Center database, and I'm sure other public libraries and other boroughs.
Yeah, the Foundation Center they produce a print booklet each year of the grants that are coming out, but that's not really the most timely way to do it. They have a subscription database that you access through your website, but I used to live in San Francisco, and I use this quite a bit, and I went just to their location, which is the one in New York in Manhattan?
Yes.
Do you know? Okay. And you can use their database there for free. Also, some public libraries will have access to their database. And what it is it's a way to search through grants that exist based on either if it's you individually, like if you're a member of a community of color or if you're queer or something like that, you can narrow grants by that. Or also with what subject matter you're dealing with and what topics you want to explore with the grant funding. And if you're in New York, going to the Foundation Center, there's really great librarians who work there who were very helpful with me when I was searching for grants.
D.C. too.
D.C.
Oh, really great there.
Great. And also, you can turn to your public library for help with grant funding. Most public libraries in especially major metropolitan areas will have classes on how to write grant applications, how to search for grants, and all that stuff, because the art of grant writing could be in another 8-week retreat, because it's a very complicated, murky sort of thing to do, but it's very essential for groups that don't have a lot of funding. And also, if this is going to be a long-term project, you'll want to think about when you're planning this out, how are you going to make this sustainable in the long run? If you're creating something that the resources are going to need to be refreshed every 2, 3, 4 years, what is there also something that can be implemented in the community to get funding, or do you need to make a partnership with a group that could provide monetary support or even like labor support or something like that? But just being sure to think of, you know, how this effort that you create can have the most longevity so that it's useful within that group. And then really just basic, you know, as a group, come up with what your ideal timeline is, and the more specific that you can be with it, the better, so that you can list out sort of step-by-step what sort of goals you want to accomplish by a certain time, what resources will be needed in that time, people, money, etc., and just sort of set up benchmarks so that you don't go through this whole phase, which in some instances I feel like people will work throughout this point and then sort of all of that hard work will get lost just on how all the details of the plan. So the more detailed that you can be with your timeline and step-by-step goals, the better. And then finally, I want to talk a little bit about reevaluating your project, because this is something too where I think a lot of other groups should share this information on what they've done, what sort of impact it had. Maybe after all this work, like, it wasn't well received. Hopefully, if your community needs assessment went well, then you were providing a service that would get a warm reception in the community. But, you know, sharing this sort of information, whether it's through you know, large gatherings like a book fair or something like that, but on sharing your findings on what worked and really what didn't work and on the process like that. And then also, once the project is actually in place in the community, check back in with the community members. You know, you can do some like a mini communities assessment or interviews to see if what is now provided is still what's needed and if it's being used, just to make sure that that all the work that you've done into that point is really paying off in the most valuable way for that community. And also, that's a good way to sort of get buy-in from the other community members who weren't a part of that initial planning process, to maybe even just re-announce, hey, we have these services, you know, we identified this 5 years ago as something that you need, is this still something that you need, and it's available to you now. So those are the steps that we're covering in this whirlwind hour of community needs assessments. Are there questions or comments? Or
on the subject of funding and seeking grants, recent decades have seen large amounts of money come into audiences that have never had money like this before. For example, dot-com kids, jam bands, all kinds of unusual entrepreneurial things. How much has the philanthropic scene changed as a result of that? Like, are these people setting up foundations that are there to be approached, or they've made money but they just aren't doing that in the way that older generations of aristocrats did? Do you have any sense of that?
I don't have any sense of that.
Yeah. I actually don't either, but that would be a really good thing to look into. Has anybody had any experience with new money and philanthropic opportunities.
New money, and also just individual donors versus grants where they're probably coming from foundations. Yeah.
Right.
So experience.
I'd like to have some experience.
Well, there is that whole...
One doesn't see anything, some of them do some token little things. I mean, Fish had the Water Wheel Foundation, mm-hmm. but, like, nothing's really changed in the scene. I mean, there's no sense that Utopian projects are being funded. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything is poor. You know, I've heard it said that the reason people that are wealthy are wealthy is because they don't give away their money. when that enters that situation, they find themselves deluged with requests from, you know, everybody, people down, they're locked, you know, everybody's got their poetry zine that they want to do or whatever,
right.
So.
Yeah, but then, I mean, we do have to keep in mind that for something to be sustainable, you know, maybe a grant could be renewed, but there does have to be a way to keep something going, you know, whether it's because it's equipment that does literally need to be refreshed. But I once went to a grassroots fundraising workshop, and I, like many people, had just been thinking, like, oh, it's grants, but the woman who led it said, you know, grants, yeah, you know, you could try to write money, you could try to hire somebody, but, you know, it's more about, like, building your circles of community around you and actually asking people, you know, for, like, will you support this project? And so I guess thinking of getting projects off the ground in the first place, that's another way to build a bond. Like, do you want a computer lab in this community? Like, let's, you know, work together, build money from the community, too.
Right. One of the things that I've heard is that grants are good for either, yeah, launching a project kind of thing or getting it off the ground or one-time purchases. But you're right. Anything that does need a sustainable funding or refreshment or like maintenance or staffing, for example, yeah, the grant's not going to do it. You're going to need more sustainable forms of money, but ways to make the project itself generate money. But this is another time where this is... something I kind of glazed over before, but when you're thinking about the members of your community and when you're talking to them, other things that you are doing and involving them in the committees is finding out what their resources are. Does somebody know, you know, does somebody work at a printing press? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and this is, as does somebody have, you know, really big space that they would love to have people using, you know, so that's another thing. It's just sort of cooperation or donations of resources, basically, in addition to money.
I think also one thing related to, well, applying for grants and also finding ways that you could get donors, long-term donors, something like that. If you're not a nonprofit, you can sometimes attach yourself to a nonprofit, but sort of keeping in mind, you need to keep in mind how much autonomy you'll have from that and sort of what compromises you'll need to make if you're attaching yourself to a larger institution or even if you're taking private donations from people like, you know, how much of a say will those people have, if any, in the efforts that you're doing? So, any other thoughts?
Questions, ideas?
Go ahead, Kayla.
Well, I feel like it's hard to ask this question because it's all about specifics, but, like, when you have a lot of specifics to be answered, for instance, if you did get a big donation, like maybe you would have to then find a lawyer to help you, like, you know, so that kind of communication barrier isn't there. So I guess my question is, other than, you know, your local library, and just a regular Google search, is there any kind of, like, I see this community toolbox website, do you know of any resources, like, specific to, you know, that kind of, you know, there's so many specifics that obviously we don't have the time to talk about. Any resources or websites or books or anything?
I don't have any other.
For a
nonprofit?
No, I guess, like, say if you did have an interview, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have, like, paper or all this audio to transcribe. I feel like there's probably, like, a software that can do that for you. But where would I find that software? You know, like, there's a lot of things like that and that are very specific questions. I'm just wondering if there's...
That's part of our 8-week program.
Yeah. Well, and also, I think that's where part of creating collaborations with other groups in the community really comes in handy. So if it's something like software, like, I know Eric's in here, so you might talk more about it, but, like, for Radical Reference, you know, they partnered with Interactivist, right? The Interactivist Network that was able to provide the tech support that was needed to create an online community like that. So it's hard without, like, a specific situation of where to provide resources. The ones that we gave you were sort of what we could fit on the slide that kind of covered generally what was community needs assessments. The Community Toolbox website is amazing and very dense, but it is really, it's a really good resource to go to. It's probably like 500, 1,000 pages
in
total.
And it goes much more in depth about community needs assessments and different steps, and includes some of the ones that we didn't. But it still is very progressive minded in that it considers the importance of direct contact and involving the community. But yeah, that's not a bad place to look. But then as far as the resources and everything, as far as what to do with the money and the infrastructure and all that, like Mama said, it's really specific to your situation.
Yeah.
So you would hope to be able to find people in your community that would help you or be able to
maybe
you
have a lawyer like within that group, or maybe someone's son is a lawyer or something like that. And even on the last slide we put in just the reminder to don't forget to ask your local librarians for help, which may even be your local Radical Reference volunteers. But for questions like that, you know, if you need a direction to be sent towards, if you're looking for a resource that will provide free or low-cost legal assistance for nonprofits, that's something that you can ask at your library to just sort of be pointed in the right direction.
They could search their own online catalog to find out what kind of book, like there might be a book that it would depend, you know, it would be specific to the collection that they had.
Too strange of a question, but all the information raises like a million other questions.
Exactly, right? And if you do have any other questions for us that you didn't have time to or didn't want to ask today, you can definitely email us and we'll be happy to get back to you.
And this little part at the bottom, the URL for radicalreference.info/anarchistbookfair/2008/CNA. That is where it's just like a brief description of the talk. We posted the slides on there, and I'm assuming that's the URL that we'll link the audio version of this talk to.
And there's also additional copies of the handout if you needed an extra one.
Oh, right.
We have a table.
So thank you so much for coming.